Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, an undead national security debate this week. The president and ex-vice president head-to-head at the National Archives yesterday, home to the U.S. Constitution and Declaration of Independence. President Obama spoke on torture, Guantanamo, and American principles in national security.
We uphold our most cherished values not only because doing so is right, but because it strengthens our country and it keeps us safe. Time and again, our values have been our best national security asset.
Immediately after the president's speech, former Vice President Dick Cheney said ruling out what some call torture would be wrong, reckless.
What's more, to completely rule out enhanced interrogation in the future is unwise in the extreme. It is recklessness cloaked in righteousness and would make the American people less safe.
And Congress passed tough new credit card legislation with a rider allowing loaded, concealed weapons in America's national parks. Democrat of California, Sam Farr.
It doesn't make any sense. This is a credit card bill, and there's no purpose in a credit card bill to have a gun bill. We talk a lot about pork in this house. I think this is an act of chicken.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining me now from Washington is Jibby Martinez. She's political columnist and contributor at Politico.com. Jibby, great to have you.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from New York is Chrystia Freeland, U.S. Managing Editor at the Financial Times. Chrystia, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jibby, and Chrystia.
What a spectacle yesterday. I cannot remember anything like it. A sitting president and ex-vice president absolutely head-to-head in the national spotlight on them, back-to-back, television broadcast, one speech, absolutely in opposition to the other. Jibby Martinez, what did you make of it?
You know, I have been thinking for the last few weeks, as Vice President Cheney has been talking, that he was out to rehabilitate his image and the Bush administration's legacy. What was interesting about yesterday is that he really was angry in his tone, suggesting that not only does he want to protect his legacy, but he also wants to attack those who would try to dismantle it, namely the Obama administration. So I think that we're going to see a playing out of this issue, obviously, some more. It's not going to end. I think that what the vice president is doing politically, though, is revving up the conservative base and kind of, I think, establishing or continuing this ticking time bomb mentality, so that if, and hopefully we don't ever have another attack again, but if we were to have another attack, he could turn to the Obama administration and say, I told you so. And that's what frightens the Obama administration. They're also looking intimidated by the vice president, I think, this week.
It's not over. It's not even history. Let's listen to a little bit more of the back and forth. First, the president, again, at the National Archives, defending his decision yesterday, just before the ex-vice president spoke, his decision to close, try to close, no funding for it yet, but to close the prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
I knew when I ordered Guantanamo closed that it would be difficult and complex. There are 240 people there who have now spent years in legal limbo. In dealing with a situation, we don't have the luxury of starting from scratch. We're cleaning up something that is quite simply a mess, a misguided experiment that has left in its wake a flood of legal challenges that my administration is forced to deal with on a constant, almost daily basis.
And you hear the echo of majesty there as he spoke literally in the presence of the very documents, the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, leaning on the pillars. Vice President Cheney was at the American Enterprise Institute, conservative think tank, criticized President Obama, saying he wasn't doing enough to keep America safe.
The administration seems to pride itself on searching for some kind of middle ground in policies addressing terrorism. They may take comfort in hearing disagreement from opposite ends of the spectrum. If liberals are unhappy about some decisions and conservatives are unhappy about other decisions, then it may seem to them that the president is on the path of sensible compromise. But in the fight against terrorism, there is no middle ground. And half measures keep you half exposed.
There is no middle ground, says the ex-Vice President Chrystia Freeland. A middle ground seemed in some sense to be exactly what Barack Obama was trying to describe and saying that's where our strength lies. The ex-Vice President says no. I wonder if the administration is regretting its decision to back off of prosecution here.
Well, I think they might be. I mean, what I thought was really interesting about yesterday was actually the extent to which the real core issues about values and philosophy were exposed and debated. You know, I think that Jibby's political analysis is absolutely correct, mm-hmm. and I think that she's absolutely right to point to the fact that the Republicans have now, and Dick Cheney has now very successfully laid a trap for President Obama. And if, God forbid, there were to be another terrorist incident in the U.S., that will be a moment when the Republicans are really able to come back and say, I told you so, but in, you know, a devastating fashion. What I thought was really important about yesterday, and where I think, in a way, Dick Cheney was actually right, was we did have a stark presentation of two opposing views of national security and of national values. There really actually ultimately isn't a middle ground between the Obama vision, which says America's greatest protection in the world is to stick to its core values, to its core belief in the rule of law, in some basic inalienable human rights, such as we don't torture people, versus the Dick Cheney view, which is security is paramount, and essentially we're prepared to do whatever we believe it takes to get there. So I thought yesterday was actually an important moment, and I think that even though the Obama administration would sort of prefer to move beyond this, it's probably important for America to engage with that moment.
Engage with it. But, Jack, I couldn't help think yesterday that this had all the hallmarks of what you would expect in a campaign season. Yeah. If this had been Obama and McCain 1 year ago, 9 months ago, it would be absolutely expected. The extraordinary piece seemed to me here, this is an ex-vice president, almost, you know, toe-to-toe with the sitting president, on a very core debate, but what an odd circumstance.
Yes, it's the debate we didn't have in the campaign because, of course, John McCain was against torture and also for the closing of Guantanamo.
As was George W. Bush.
As was George W. Bush. And 130 million people in total voted for that proposition because both candidates stood for it. So here we have the vice president saying, you were all wrong. You know, I think yesterday was really a confrontation between the right side and the dark side. The dark side is the phrase that Dick Cheney famously used about, you know, we needed to go into the over onto the dark side to defeat the terrorists. And Obama was saying, no, we don't. No, we don't. And when we do that, we weaken ourselves. And even put it practically and asked people that care about the military to reflect, first of all, would you surrender to someone who was going to torture you? No. And if you're taken prisoner, what's going to prevent them from torturing you? Nothing. And, of course, that's exactly what the Cheney policy did, which was make U.S. All subsequent U.S. soldiers, you know, at risk of being tortured. And the Cheney presentation, I thought, was a farrago of falsities. You know, he claimed that Congress, that the 9/11 resolution gave the authority to the administration to torture. Arnold Spector said years ago about that, he said, I did not vote to condone torture when I voted for this, and neither did any of the other representatives. He said that every method we use was in compliance with the Constitution. The Eighth Amendment to the Constitution bans cruel and unusual punishment. He said that the one purpose of this of these, quote, you know, alternative techniques was to prevent terrorism. That's not so. I mean, the Senate intelligence report makes clear that they tortured an Egyptian man to get information about connecting Saddam with 9/11, so they could
trying
make the so they could make a political case, not about stopping a terrorist attack, but about justifying the attack on Iraq.
Jack, let me get a caller in right here, and we'll go on down that list. Starkesboro, Vermont. Pat, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think, Pat?
Well, I think that the whole fact that we're having this conversation is a testament to Cheney's power. And I think that Obama has got to be wise about this, wiser about this, and not set up. It was a virtual debate yesterday, the way that with the timing. And he's got to back off from this. The Republicans are great at this. I should say the right-wing Republicans are so good at this. This is what they did to Clinton for 4 years, 8 years. You know, ankle biting until they just to distract. We voted these people out. We know Cheney is dangerous. This has been well established. And for Obama to get into any kind of discussion with him or allow there to be any semblance of a debate with this man is a huge mistake.
Pat, let us pick it up. Jibby, ankle biting here or kind of backseat driving the bus?
Well, I'll tell you what I think made Obama so vulnerable is announcing that he was going to close Guantanamo without having a plan. Because that created the opening not just for Republicans, but also for Democrats who might be vulnerable to Republican attacks in their states. And
to vote against the funding for it, which they did.
Right. And it was overwhelming. I mean, when you have 50 Democrats in the Senate voting against the president, it was actually a good vote for them to take because it was not something that involved an immediate crisis. It can be further negotiated, and it's a way of saying that they're not going to rubber stamp the president on everything. And it gives the president now an opportunity to come back with a plan. And as we saw in the speech yesterday, he really did have a lack of specifics. You know, we now know from him after yesterday's speech that there will be indefinite detention of some who cannot be prosecuted because the case was
just too gnarly. We'll talk about
Republic.
That. Jibby, we've got to take a break. It's an odd moment, a loaded moment, and we don't just mean guns in the national parks. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news, Obama, Cheney, Guantanamo, emissions, credit cards, and guns in the national parks, loaded. There was the big Uber debate, high concept, about some low and high stuff on national security, and then the issue of Guantanamo itself and whether it should be shut down. Republicans and Democrats going at it. Here's Republican Senator Oklahoma, Senator James Inhofe, arguing against the closing of the prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, saying the least the U.S. pays Cuba is a bargain.
$4,000 a year, that's all it cost us. So this is a resource that we need to keep, we have to keep. The only argument that I hear against it is, oh, the Europeans don't want that. Well, where are the Europeans? You know, I'm getting a little bit tired of having them dictate what we do in the United States.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, one of the few in the GOP to agree with President Obama that Guantanamo should be closed. Here he was talking before Congress, noted the U.S. previously held German and Japanese prisoners on the mainland during World War II.
The idea that we cannot find a place to securely house 250-plus detainees within the United States is not rational. We have done this before. They're not 10 feet tall.
And here's the Democratic voice, Dianne Feinstein, chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, explaining why she voted against the funding to close Guantanamo.
It was a hopeless cause at that point. There was no plan. And I regret very much, but an $80 million appropriation with no plan to use it fell right smack dab into the trap. And the trap was that the Democrats want to free terrorists to go into the communities and neighborhoods of America. And nothing could be further from the truth.
Let's go right to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Doug, you're on the air.
Hi. I support the president's view. It's pretty clear that Dick Cheney is playing politics. He's trying to stir America up again and keep us fearful. The reality is his judgment led us into a war that when we started, it was going to be quick and easy. And here we still are in Iraq trying to get out. The president described it correctly when he said he was left a mess. American values, we can't go it alone in this world. It is a global world. The fact of the matter is that our demographics, the world is changing.
Yeah.
We need allies. We need to be working with our traditional allies, and we don't need to be fueling terrorist groups. And let's face it, Senator McCain supports the president's position on torture.
Doug, we've got it. And I guess that was the view, you could say, that was endorsed by voters in November, but the ex-vice president isn't buying it. He's still arguing his big case. Thanks for your call. Let's get one from Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello. I listened to Christie's comment. I think she's right about Dick Cheney laying a trap for Obama. But in a larger sense, he also laid a trap for America. And I'm thinking in particular about this line. It's hard to imagine a worse precedent filled with more possibilities for trouble and abuse than to have an incoming administration criminalize the policy decisions of its predecessors. And if he is successful...
Cheney said that.
Mm-hmm. Cheney said that yesterday. Mm-hmm. And if he is successful in getting in heading off prosecutions, which are needed to show that these are crimes, then he will have established that that torture is nothing but a policy decision. And when Obama is out of the White House, future presidents will be confronted with the question, well, why aren't you doing everything possible? Why aren't you adopting a policy that would torture those people to get this information? This is a trap for America. He needs to be prosecuted. We need to put an end to this discussion as to whether torture is permissible.
Mark, we've got it, and thank you. Christian, what about, I mean, here is the ex-vice president arguing right in the face of the sitting president, who has very clearly enunciated his view against it. Doesn't that give fodder to those who say, without prosecution, you have an outside the bounds of the Constitution theory of the case still fully at work here, ready to come back as soon as we get a different administration? There's no line in the sand. Dick Cheney, is he proving that in a way right there in Washington right now?
I think that is absolutely the case. I think that Dick Cheney's speech yesterday really ultimately could end up boomeranging against Dick Cheney, because the only real lasting retort that Obama will have if this debate continues will be to take it to its rational extreme. And if that's not prosecutions, I think it will at the very least be some sort of public investigation, maybe something along the lines of the 9/11 Commission. I agree with what Jack was saying earlier about the American people having, in electing President Obama, and also actually in the Republican primary voters in choosing John McCain, voted against torture. But I don't think a full national debate, a full national discussion of that issue has happened. The polls show, actually, that support for President Obama is relatively weak when it comes to the torture issue compared to, say, his support on economic issues. And I think also something that America hasn't really grappled with is the extent to which there was cross-party complicity in some of the torture issues, and complicity that extended, you know, to journalists. There was a moment when really there wasn't a lot of dissent in America around this issue. And I do think, you know, as Doug was saying, or as Mark was saying,
of course, not everything was known from the get-go. Journalists did dig it out over time.
Yeah, but things did become known. We've had the Abu Ghraib pictures, for example, for a long time. We've known that there were some instances of waterboarding for a long time. And I think it was Mark who said, you know, America does have to make clear whether it is a nation that does not accept torture in any circumstances, or whether torture is kind of a policy decision, and it depends on how scared America feels.
Jack, how about it? I mean, there was an election, and Dick Cheney, you know, was voted out, but not down, as it turns out. Now Obama is arguing him. He deliberately set his speech on the same day as Cheney's. He wanted this head-to-head conference. Will arguing do this? Is something else needed?
I think some spine is needed, and I think the president showed that. I mean, he affirmed American values. He told his Senate colleagues, don't let a 30-second political ad frighten you. You took an oath to uphold the Constitution, too, and we have to follow through on the commitment I've made to close Guantanamo because it's not consistent with the Constitution. I think that Mark really raised the key point here, though, and that is the narrative that Cheney was giving, which I think could take hold and could essentially freeze, which is torture worked. We weren't attacked, therefore it's justified by the results. That is such a, you know, if more people accept that, then we're really, really in bad shape. Not only because it's wrong, but because, as Mark says, it'll come back. We'll hear it again. But, you know, unfortunately, meeting this week with civil libertarians at the White House, the president made it very clear, and according to one source, he looked at Eric Holder when he said, there will be no more prosecutions or inquiry about this. Essentially, he was having a politically interfering with the attorney general and saying to him, we're not going to go that route. Whereas earlier, of course, he said, oh, it's up to Mr. Holder. Well, clearly it isn't. He wants no part of any kind of inquiry or truth commission or anything of that sort because he thinks that it would hold his program on the economy hostage.
Jack, I wonder, though, what you think of the middle way, the balance that Obama is explicitly trying to carve out here, saying, look, we have to respect and be seen to respect our values, but he's still asking for some wiggle room here. Maureen Dowd had some fun this week. She was imagining Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld in a cafe in Georgetown. You know, and they're muttering to each other, the punks thought they could roll over us, Cheney says. And Rummy says, I can't believe how easy it was to bring Obama into line. Cheney says, transparency bites. But they kind of go through the list of compromises, middle way things here. She's quoting Rumsfeld. This is all made up, but there's reality in here, too. He says, you got Obama to do an about face on the torture photos. He's keeping our military tribunals. Justice invoked state secrets privilege to get a lawsuit on torture and rendition dismissed. He's got his own surge going in Afghanistan. He's withdrawing from Iraq more slowly. He's extended our secret incursions over the Afghan border into Pakistan. Is Obama coming halfway toward the Bush that he criticized so, Bush administration that he criticized so thoroughly in the campaign, Jack?
Yes, in a word, he went from the poetry of campaigning to the prose of governance. And in that prose, issues of safety of the troops are paramount. And when the generals came to him about the photographs and said, you let these things out now, and you're putting these kids' lives at risk, any president, I think, would do that. Also, he's got to give a speech in Egypt in, a couple of weeks. Does he want these photographs out on the Internet while he's doing that? Of course not. I mean, that was a prudential decision. And, military tribunals, I don't think that's a good idea. He wants to do that because, of course, again, it produces a certain amount of political cover for him. He's trying to put together he criticized the Bush administration for an ad hoc approach. His approach is ad hoc, too, but it starts at least anchored in the basic values. We will close Guantanamo because it's an affront to the decent opinion of mankind. Nothing we have ever done, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said, has hurt us in foreign policy more than that. We're going to do that, and we aren't going to torture. Those are the big things. And if he can keep those big fundamental changes there, that's a huge difference from Bush.
If I could add something real quickly, I mean, I go back to my original point, which is that the president, outlined his principles but didn't have a plan to accompany that, and that gave the Republican conservatives the opening to come in and attack him for doing nothing or for being weak on national security. I mean, one of the things that the conservatives have always been really good at is creating fear and playing on fear. Even yesterday, Vice President Cheney referred to 9/11 27 times in a 36-minute speech. And,
that's not easy.
We thought we were kind of past that. I thought when you talked about, you were asking who should step up to the plate here and speak more. I mean, frankly, I think some of the more interesting comments have come from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who was from the Bush administration originally, remember?
Yep.
And, he is saying that there's a lot of fear-mongering going on about closing Guantanamo. And he says that, he's reminding people that one of the reasons why it should be closed is because, given all the bad that's happened there, it's kind of a free advertisement for Al-Qaeda as long as it stays open. So there's this sort of moral reason and PR reason why it should be closed.
Maybe a practical security reason right there as well. Let me get a call here, Jimmy, if I may, from Amherst, Massachusetts. Gordon, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. This is Gordon from Amherst, and I am calling because something that a lot of your readers or listeners might not have noticed, which I did. I'm a Vietnam veteran, combat vet, and Dick Cheney snuck in his version of a war story in what he was saying in those 30 minutes, and where he was sitting in the bunker beneath the White House during 9/11.
Taking us back to that day and him there in the midst of the national crisis, yes.
Right, but my point is that for me, and I'm certain because I've been I've been in many groups with other vets, and there's nothing that is more put-offing than people puffing up their war stories. And I think, at least, certainly for me, and I'll bet you for many, many veterans, that was an incredible turn off. And
yeah, Dick Cheney with his, was it four or five Vietnam War era deferments? Gordon, thanks for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get another right here from Litchfield, Connecticut. Gregory, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Greg. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to voice my support for allowing guns in national parks. You know, guns are pretty much allowed everywhere, and I don't think a national park is inherently any more safe than anywhere else. And I watch Animal Planet, and sometimes I hear about these bear attacks and whatever it could be, and I think, you know, if I were going to a national park, I'd like to bring my firearm.
And would you feel good knowing everybody there's got one? The guy in the pup tent next over going to, I don't know what, hear you rustling at night and pull out his Magnum?
You're camping out. You know, you feel happier having your gun with you. You know, people who have guns, I think, generally are very law-abiding citizens, and I don't worry about other citizens having guns, especially if they're licensed, which I believe this new law or regulation requires that they be licensed in their state.
Greg, we've got it. We thank you for your call. Happy with that gun in the woods. Christian, how did that get tacked on to a credit card bill? What happened there?
Well, I very much like the comment you had, I think, from one of the lawmakers saying that people have been complaining about pork. This is an example of chicken. I think that was absolutely right. Clearly, the Congress was very keen to push this credit card measure through, and they decided that they didn't have time to take issue with the attachment of the gun provision, which, whatever your actual view on whether we need to have guns in our tents when we go visit national parks, clearly is very distant from restrictions on credit card.
But Democrats in the majority all over the place, they were not in a position to stop this, or they were sympathetic with it. They also wanted guns and Smokey Bear and all the rest.
I think it was a mixture of expediency, wanting to get this bill through, and also not wanting to have that debate right now.
Jack, what do you say? You going to be taking your shotgun on the family camping expedition?
To protect myself against rabbits. I mean, you know, this is the kind of thing that leads you to despair of American politics. This is strictly the National Rifle Association showing that 27 Democrats to support them from rural states, a mindless step that could endanger living things of all species in national forests. And it's just, you know, it just shows again the grip of special interests on our polity. I mean, it is, and you talk about fear. I mean, chicken. Yeah, that's exactly what was involved here. These legislators were just terribly afraid that the NRA would attack them and of course, the NRA has made the whole issue of assault weapons. With that, you can't even talk about banning those. I mean, that's, oh my God, disarming the populace. We can't have that.
We will come back.
Tom,
Jibby, yes.
Just real quickly, yeah. I mean, this is also says, you know, broadly how the Democratic Congress did become Democratic, which is by electing a lot of people from rural areas where gun rights are sacred. Mm-hmm. So the Democrats don't, you know, even though they have the majority, they don't have a gun control majority, that's for sure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A red-blue sing-off on American Idol this week, and Mickey Mouse in the news. On the American Idol finale, San Diego's eyelinered Adam Lambert rocked the house with Kiss to screaming fans.
Adam, you say you want to go for a spin. The party's just begun, we'll let you near. You drive us wild, we'll drive you crazy.
But at the end of the night, it was straight-ahead hometown boy from Conway, Arkansas, Chris Allen, who won the vote as American Idol.
Yeah.
And Mickey Mouse will have to find a new voice after 32 years of bringing on the Disney character's falsetto. Mickey voice master Wayne Allwine has died.
Listen to this. Earn $999.99 for a mindless day's work. Oh, boy, I'm back in business.
Three voices, two in the spotlight, one gone by. We've got a little more on guns and parks right here. Heather in Warwick, Rhode Island. You're on the air, Heather.
Hi. I'm going to say this really put a bee in my bonnet. I called both my senators and I called Harry Reid because I want the Senate rules changed. And you know, I'm not even necessarily against guns in national parks, but I realize that in some of the western states in particular, you might need a gun to protect yourself against mountain lions and stuff like that. Whether it needs to be loaded or not, I think we need to have a discussion, and they completely circumvented that. But more importantly, this just leads to the cynicism that people have about our government because there's no accountability. Somebody could say, oh, I didn't like the bill, but I voted for it because I really wanted the amendment. Or they could say, I did like the bill, but I couldn't live with the amendment.
Right.
And where is the accountability if they're allowed to pull stuff like this? And it really, the Senate rules really need to be changed on this.
It was such a rabbit out of the hat. I know exactly what you mean, Heather. You've got credit card reform, and by the way, you've got loaded guns in the national parks. Congratulations, America. Tom, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, you're on the air. Hi, Tom. What do you know?
To me, it seems like the allowing guns allows a person to go into the national park. What I'm getting at is if you're trying to be legal and you normally carry a gun in your vehicle, then you're going to avoid the national parks, and I think that's discriminating.
What about leaving it home for just a day and bringing a picnic basket, fried chicken?
I have an RV, and so if I'm on a long trip, I don't have a gun and don't carry one. But if I were, then I'm just have to avoid the national parks. It's not like you leave it at home and go for the day.
Yeah, where you go, your gun goes, and the national parks are now more open to you. I wonder, if there's a, Jack, you said NRA, but we've also heard these stories over the years about more and more national parks being used to grow marijuana, about gangs and drug dealers in there, heavily armed. I mean, is there some other reality here that I'm just not attuned to, that it's not safe to go in there anymore, or is that hype? I don't know if you know or not, Jack.
I don't know. It seems highly improbable that they're dangerous. It just seems on the face of it to be implausible. Sure, there are irregular things that happen in there, but to compare, say, a block in the Bronx or in any city with what happens in a particular 100 square miles of national park, I mean, obviously you take your chance with the national park. I mean, it really, I think, is a silly, the idea that somehow people are at risk there, and even this notion of wild animals. I mean, I once saw a longitudinal study of bear attacks, and over the last 100 or so years, there have just been a handful of these things, and almost in all cases, it's been because a person was all alone. And the more people you have with you, the less likely it becomes that a bear will even know you're there. So if you're afraid of bears, bring company.
You know, Christian, I wonder if in a funny way this goes back to a piece of the same Obama-Cheney argument about what kind of country this is. I mean, do you go off to the national parks with, potato salad and Frisbees, or do you go off with potato salad and Frisbees and, a loaded Glock on your hip, an assault rifle in the RV?
You know, I actually think that it's more about the urban-rural divide, and I do think that Tom made an important cultural point that, if you come from a community where you just have a gun in your pickup truck all the time, as, for example, my dad does, then I think that this makes a little bit more sense. But I think that Heather made the most important point about this legislation, which is, to me, the key issue is not whether it's sensible to have guns in national parks or not. It's that it's the way that this legislation was pushed through and the way that it inevitably is going to add to national cynicism about what really goes on in Washington and whether issues are debated on their merits or whether it's all about procedural games. And I think it's not in the interests of lawmakers overall from either of the parties for the American public to have a perception that actually no one is really prepared in Washington to debate things on their merits, and everyone just wants to play the game.
And you know, you may be right on the culture, but I grew up 100% rural, and when we went hunting, we took the guns out. And we went picnicking, we took the picnic basket out. Jimmy?
Tom? Yeah. I wanted to point out one key difference here is that the current law, as it now stands, allows people to take guns into parks as long as they're not loaded.
Mm-hmm.
And what this change does is say that they can take them loaded and concealed. Now, in my opinion, this was an advancement of the gun rights agenda purely and politically, very simply.
Because they could. Let's go to Memphis, Tennessee, and Matt, talking of guns, but also it's attached to the credit card bill. What do you see out there, Matt?
Hey, how are you doing today?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Well, as calling about the credit card bill, I've scanned through it briefly. The problem that we're dealing with is that, as background, I teach, volunteer my time for a local agency with folks who are, disadvantaged, and I deal specifically with personal financial management. And I have found in my experience that when I sit down and explain to these folks how a credit card works, how a loan works, how these concepts of risk work, and what the credit card looks at on a balance sheet when they look at someone, they become very smart, very quick, and have the tools to change their habits.
Hmm.
A lot of this discussion, honestly, you can't enforce common sense and education. You can only teach education, and a lot of this debate is politicized. The bigger issue to me, from my perspective and in this experience, is why are folks not being taught basic stuff about money?
Educate consumers on borrowing and dealing with finances. Christian, this was presented as by Obama. Almost as protection against credit card company piracy on consumers. What do you see the impact of this going forward? Do you think is this going to save the people Matt's talking about, or is it going to change lending for all Americans? Borrowing?
Well, I think ultimately what this bill does is it moves the risks and rewards from one group to another. You know, obviously the credit card companies will have fewer opportunities to make profits on some of these more indebted consumers. But that, in the end, may actually trickle down into a negative impact on you if you're a person who pays your credit card bill on time every month, is never overdrawn. If you're a person like that, then actually, overall, you're probably benefiting from the fact that maybe your neighbor has a huge overdraft and is paying the credit card company outrageous rates of interest. What it does do, though, is create a protection. You know, it means that there are fewer pitfalls for people who either because they lack this financial education or because they get trapped in a spiral of debt, which can happen to anyone. You know, I think that Edmund Andrews, a reporter for the New York Times, has written a really interesting new book about what happened to him in his own personal life, and that included being caught in some of these credit card traps. Now, he's a hyper-educated consumer. He's someone who's actually been writing about this stuff himself. Yet, when it's your own life, it is easy to fall into temptation. Now, is it the government's responsibility to keep temptation away from us? That's a larger debate, and maybe, you know, this bill at least limits the amount of financial temptation to which we may all be subject.
Let's go to Wendy in Watertown, Massachusetts. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi. I am a member of a credit union, and two things have happened. One is it's a digital federal credit union. They have now raised interest rates across the board, supposedly, in regardless of your credit rating. And I didn't understand what your commentator just said because my understanding is that there's a real risk to those of us, I love this, that are called deadbeats by the banks.
Meaning?
That those of us who pay off every month are likely to end up with more costs than we have now.
I think
yes,
that's what
right.
Chris is saying. Yes, exactly.
That's exactly right. Because
counterintuitive.
But because they won't be taking such big fees and high interest rates out of those who have lagged rather than pay off.
Right. And I'm wondering if all these things are not going to also apply to the credit unions since they seem to be reacting.
It sounds as though there will be higher costs on that front. There's a trade-off, and we'll no doubt be hearing more about it. I want to move, because our time gets a little bit short here, to the environmental front. Jibby, you covered the auto industry out of Detroit for some time. We've got higher emission standards coming, and coming ahead of any schedule that was anticipated before. Some are saying hallelujah, some are saying too much, some are saying too late. How do you see what just happened here, Jibby?
I actually thought it was pretty remarkable because, there were times in Congress when you never could have reached any kind of agreement on, CAFE standards, auto fuel efficiency standards. One of the most powerful members of the House is John Dingell, who back then was the ranking Democrat on the House Energy and Commerce Committee, was not going to allow anything like that to happen. And in the Senate, Carl Levin and Debbie Stabenow, the senators from Michigan, were very, very tough on this. But there's been just a confluence of a lot of events that have made this happen. I mean, one is obviously the downturn of the auto industry. Secondly, this very big, great debate over global warming and the, uptick in environmental debate now for the last few years. And I think everyone just realizing that they had to be pragmatic and come together, or they were going to be almost legislated out of business.
But you don't even mention the enormous new leverage that Washington has on the auto industry with all the billions that they've cranked into their coffers.
Exactly. I mean, here we see the administration getting ready to bring Chrysler out of bankruptcy under this very controlled policy. And now headlines today are that the federal government is now trying to drive GM into bankruptcy protection so that they can restructure that as well. So, the automakers really had no leverage here. And so this was a perfect time for the environmentalists to come in together with the, oil companies and the manufacturers. And that display on the White House lawn where they came together to announce this was really pretty remarkable. You could not have imagined that even 3 or 4 years ago.
Jack, we've also got cap and trade on carbon emissions this week coming out of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, putting it on the road to becoming law. A former vice president, another VP, Al Gore, says a crucial step forward. But you've got the head of Greenpeace USA saying, this needs to be based on science, not based on which lobbyist paid the most. Not enough, they say. What do you say, Jack?
Well, that Al Gore is for it, it justifies it in my view. It's hard to imagine that he would come out and say, he wouldn't give his benediction to something that didn't make sense. And by making sense, it's got to make political sense, too. I think what Henry Waxman has done on this committee, and they just finished it up last night, was really remarkable. They worked out a compromise between coastal representatives like him and Ed Markey of Massachusetts, representatives from coal-producing regions like Southern Virginia, and representatives from the industrial heartland, and they all got together on a compromise. That's really quite striking, and it never would have happened under Dingell. Meanwhile, of course, what have the Republicans done? They didn't support this. They probably won't vote for any part of it. And the House leadership has appointed two members to its committee, its study group, that's coming up with alternatives on this energy front. And one of them is a global warming denier, and the other one seems to be a denier of evolution. So they're not really, they're not even trying, it seems, to get into the real alternative business.
But more green controversy to come on that. We may look at it. Yes, Christian?
Yeah, just to jump in really quickly, I absolutely agree with what Jibby and Jack have said, but I would like to point out that there is one important dog that hasn't barked in all of these car and cap and trade debates, and that is a tax on gasoline. That would be, I realize, politically very, very difficult, if not impossible, in the American context, but that would be the simplest, most direct, least vulnerable to unintended consequences measure that the government could push through to improve both the environmental standards of cars and, in general, to discourage use of fuel.
We'll see what comes. We haven't even come to the four men arrested on Wednesday in what was said to be a plot to bomb two synagogues in the Bronx, maybe shoot down American military planes. Matthew Cambridge, our time is very short, but you're on the air, Matthew.
Thank you. It was said earlier that what Cheney has said about Guantanamo puts President Obama at risk. It could be the other way around, because the event you just referred to, Tom, if that had gone through, or an even bigger homegrown terrorist event, especially when these gentlemen seem to have said it was American policy that made him so angry, the shoe would be on the other foot.
So bear in mind, Dick Cheney has a point, you say.
Yeah, Cheney has only his own reputation at stake. Obama has the efficiency of an administration at stake. The real imbalance is to see a private individual trying to hold up the whole administration's policy by attacking in a way that really puts him in as much jeopardy as the other way around.
But Jimmy Martinez, there it was, those arrests. I mean, it turns out they'd been infiltrated. Their driver was an informant. The plastic explosives or explosives at the temple door were never going to go off. The missile wasn't going to work. Nevertheless, there was the intent. There will be no small number in this country who look at that, listen to Dick Cheney, and say, he's got a point.
Except that it wasn't very well organized.
No.
And I think that it speaks to the law enforcement community that they picked up on it right away. They followed it. They, you know, I read a quote in the New York Times this morning from the sister of one of those who was arrested who said, in paraphrasing, that her brother is like the dumbest man she's ever known. You know, so that kind of told me something about the plot.
Well, he's in trouble now. Christian, we didn't even get to the economy looming over all this. A quick thumbs up down which
and
way we headed.
And that's a tragedy for Obama, right? I mean, this goes to Jack's point that what Obama really would like is for us to be talking about the economy and his economic initiatives. But I guess he lost that tactical political battle this week.
Lost it this week, but it's still a big frame out there. We'll come to it. Christian Freeland with the Financial Times. It is always great to have you. Thank you very much for sitting with us this week.
Pleasure.
Jimmy Martinez with Politico. Thanks for joining us, Jimmy.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, have a great Memorial Day weekend, Jack. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.